Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. Podcasts are also available under local programming, Your Financial Choices. Today is January 15th, 2020. The markets were up today, with the Dow closing at 29,030 from last week of 28,745. The NASDAQ was up to 92.58 from 91.21 last week. And the S&P was 32.89 last week, 32.53. So all up even from last week. A listener had called and said one time, wouldn't it be nice if you said last week's closings compared to the current. So that's what I'm trying to do. Our topic tonight is trusts. When do they make sense? This is going to be a great topic, and we're going to talk about even a little bit more than trust as well when we're talking about estate planning, which is typically what we think of for trust. We are live tonight. We will take your questions. Lori C's in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments, and while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I'll do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. We are fortunate this evening to have with us a guest, attorney Nicholas Nanovic with Gross McGinley. Nick has over 10 years of experience partnering with clients in designing comprehensive and customized estate plans, as well as navigating complex tax matters. Nick strives to understand the goals of his clients, utilizing various types of trust to ensure assets are protected for future generations. As chair of Gross McGinley's Wills, Trust, and Estates Group, he leads a team of attorneys, paralegals, and staff in improving quality and efficiencies with regard to estate planning and estate administration services. Nick has attained the designation of an accredited estate planner awarded by the National Association of Estate Planners and Councils, as well as holding an LLM. Passionate about the importance of estate planning for all individuals, Nick is a longtime volunteer with the Wills for Heroes program that provides free basic estate planning documents to first responders and military veterans in Pennsylvania. He currently serves as coordinator for Lehigh and Northampton counties. He is a Pennsylvania super lawyer. According to Super Lawyers Magazine, he was named to its Rising Stars list for the past 5 years, including 2019, a distinction awarded to less than 2.5% of attorneys across the state, probably because he's such a nice guy as well. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Finally, we've talked about it for a long time, and I'm glad that we finally got you here. Thanks to Andrea, your new marketing person reaching out, and we got together, which is great because she made happen what you and I weren't making happen. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? We know a little bit about the background and what you're doing at Gross McGinley. What about you personally?
Sure. I've been here in the Lehigh Valley for the past 12 years, practicing as an attorney in the estate planning world, estate administration. Grew up not far from here, up in Jim Thorpe in Carbon County. Married, wife, little daughter of 20 months as of yesterday. Mm-hmm. Hi, Beth. Hi, Piper. I think they're tuned in listening to us tonight. This has just been become my passion over the year, helping out families and individuals plan their goals and wishes so that their families and loved ones don't have to worry about cleaning up any messes if it's not planned the right way.
Yeah, and when you then have your own family, you really realize the need for it even more.
Correct.
It's like when I told my 23-year-old son, someday you'll understand when you're a parent, and you don't always understand what it means to raise a child until you're a parent. You don't always understand estate planning unless you're in need, you know, something untoward happens. And so it's really your goal, my goal. The Estate Planning Council, which we're both members of, too. We love being part of that organization. It's really our goal to help people get their estate planning done and their estate documents. Very, very important. So we did title the show tonight, and we could talk about an array of topics around estate planning. But tonight, Nick and I decided we were going to talk about trust and when does one make sense. But I think we should still start with, you know, explaining what trusts are, and there from there, it will be a little bit easier to talk about when they make sense. And we should talk about existing trust or trust documents that may need updating or, you know, a review. But first, because you are an estate planning attorney, can we just set the table at this in the initial few minutes to talk about some of the basic estate documents that everyone should have?
Sure. So in my opinion, I think that the basic documents for everyone who's 18 or older is basically a will, a power of attorney, and a health care directive, which is also sometimes known as a health care power of attorney or a living will. The will, I think most people are familiar with, directs where you want your assets to go upon your death, who should be the executor, marshaling those assets, making sure they get to the right place. And if you have young children, you can also name in that document who your guardian for those children should be until they reach adulthood. The power of attorney, it's more of a living document. So while you're alive, if you need any assistance with your financial management, legal decision making, you use that document to name the person who has that authority. And the health care directive, very similar, except for health care choices. If you can't make your choices for whatever reason, speak to your doctor who's making those health care choices for you. So to me, those are the three very important documents that everyone should have.
And it's interesting because you specifically said anyone age 18 and over.
Yes. Many people, there's lots of misconceptions with estate planning in general. One of them is that if I don't have anything, I don't need estate planning. And, you know, for someone who turns 18, 19, maybe in college, may only be accruing debt without any assets, maybe that's true to a will, but that's not true as it applies to a power of attorney or health care directive. I've worked with many parents who have children in college, and there may be issues with them at school that the school can't communicate with them because there's no power of attorney or health care directive on file giving the school authority to talk to those parents about what's happening with their children while they're adults and living away from home.
Yeah, and stuff happens when the kids are away from.
Absolutely.
My daughter was a freshman in college. We got a call at 5 in the morning. She said, come get me. I'm really, really sick. And she could still speak for herself. So so the health care power of attorney wasn't needed at that time. But, you know, if she had severe mono, and that could have gone any which direction. So that's interesting, Nick. I'm thinking we're just hitting on something that really that could be when we talk to our clients about estate planning, that could be a gift that they give their kids before they go to college. Let's go into the attorney and let's get some documents for you.
Absolutely.
I don't think we talk about it like that.
I think it needs to be talked about a lot more than it currently is. I hear very few people talking about this. There are a few people who come to me and ask for this for their college-age children, their kids who just graduate high school and turn 18. But I think it is very important, and it's a very underserved area of the community.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, so we talked about will, power of attorney, health care, basic documents. Might not include or could have a will, but that will may not include a trust, or people may not think they need a separate trust document. Mm-hmm. So, folks, we're at our first break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about when you might have not a separate document for a trust, but you might have a trust in your will. And so we want to talk about when we would see that and what that means. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it into the studio. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and we have in the studio with us this evening Nick Nanovic, attorney with Gross McGinley, working in their Wills, Trust, and Estates group. In fact, Nick chairs their group. So we've got the right person on the show tonight. We are talking about trust and when do they make sense. Nick just gave us an outline of some of the basic documents, and those typically, the basic documents may not include a trust. But Nick, we may see that someone might not have a separate trust document and may not even realize within their will they might have a trust. So can you talk about what does that mean?
Sure. So what you're talking about is what us lawyers call a testamentary trust. And basically what that means is it's a trust that's in your last will and testament document, and it does not actually come into existence until after you pass away and that will gets lodged at the courthouse. Where that's typically making most sense is where you have beneficiaries, whether they're children or young adults, or whoever they may be, and they're not financially mature enough to possibly manage the inheritance that they could be inheriting from you. So you want to set up this trust entity whereby they're still benefiting from it. You can set the rules so they can still get money for tuition, medical expenses, whatever their basic support is. But you have someone else who may be more responsible than them managing it, making sure that money lasts for a much longer time than if it was put into their own personal hands.
Okay. excuse me. Okay, so that is a testamentary trust, and it could be for minor children. It could be for children who might not have the capacity or whatever reason. And you also said you can put in certain rules or provisions. So you can work on that in for circumstances that you can't always foresee. For example, you mentioned you have a 20-month-old daughter. So this is about being prepared in the event something unexpected, unforeseen happens, and to kind of give direction to those people who will be ongoing. You may not be able to anticipate everything, but with your attorney, they can put in broad management provisions and
Yeah, absolutely. All of that. I mean, using myself as a prime example, you know, my 20-month-old daughter, I don't know how she's going to be as a teenager. I hope she's not a handful, but I'm, you know, not banking on that. I don't know how she's going to be as a young adult. So God forbid something happens to me before I see her mature to those ages. I need to kind of predict what that possibly could be, the best case and worst case scenarios, and decide in my own personal estate plan, am I going to set up some sort of trust for her until she's in her 20s or 30s or 40s? Or am I going to be comfortable that she just has everything in her own name at a certain point, and I just let her make her own choices at that point in life?
Okay. And I think that a big takeaway from tonight's show is for those listeners who have these fears of, I don't know what to do, I'm not sure how I should do this. In the documents, the attorneys can provide a lot of flexibility.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So you don't have to have the fear of knowing all the answers. You can work with the attorney. They know the terms that typically you need to pay attention to, and they'll work out that part of it. So please, let's take the fear out of estate work. It really isn't fearful if you do it the right way. So we've talked now about a testamentary trust. That's a trust under the will. Some people will have separate trust documents, and they have all kinds of different names. And my mother calls me on the phone, Lorianne, my friends all say I have to have a trust. Nick, what could they be talking about? What kind of other trust might someone have?
The most common trust that I experience that doesn't exist as a testamentary trust is a revocable trust, sometimes known as a living trust. And basically what that is, it's a separate document that can own the assets that you own yourself. Where it comes in handy, in Pennsylvania at least, is maybe in a situation where you have real estate in another state. And you don't want your family to have estate administrations in two or three or four states. So instead of having an estate administration in a state where you have a beach house or a vacation home, whatever it is, you put that home into a revocable trust. And now it's Pennsylvania property, and whenever your time is, your family only has to administer that here in Pennsylvania instead of every single state where your real estate is located.
Okay, and you said you can put assets into the trust, for example, this out-of-state home. Mm-hmm. Do you have to put all your assets into it?
You do not. A large marketing tool for living trust and revocable trust is that you'll save fees. You'll avoid probate. That is true. You'll avoid probate if everything is in the trust. Where I see a lot of people make mistakes or it's not the ideal planning is that there's always something that they forgot to put into the trust. And now you have to probate anyways and take that will to the courthouse and move it into the trust. And in Pennsylvania, unlike many other states, the probate fees are relatively inexpensive, depending if we're talking...
The whole probate process is not that bad.
The probate process is a trip to the courthouse, maybe 15, 20 minutes, process some paperwork, and that's it. The overall fees for those depends on the county. Could be between $500 and $1,500, say for if it's $1 million even. So when you're talking as a percentage of the fees versus the value of the estate, setting up revocable trust, to me in Pennsylvania at least, they're oversold a lot of times. They do come in handy. As I mentioned, out-of-state real estate, it's nice to have that to protect it from several estate administrations. Another time it may come in handy is if you want to set up a trustee, start them managing it while you're still alive and competent. You can watch them how they manage it so that if you're predicting that you have some sort of chronic illness, you know that you have family history of Alzheimer's, dementia, and you want to protect yourself and your assets mm-hmm. from whenever you may enter that stage yourself, you can put it into this revocable trust, turn it over to a trustee, and see how they're doing with it. And if you don't like how they're doing, hey, it's revocable. You can pull it back out and keep it in your own name or name someone else who's going to be that trustee whenever that may be needed in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so could be a very good idea mm-hmm. with real estate outside of outside of Pennsylvania. So that's kind of a real flag.
Yes.
Outside of that, it really would be a discussion with the attorney whether it really would be necessary or not.
It is. I mean, a lot of other misconceptions with the living trust is that it provides privacy. If it's in a trust, it's private as opposed to in my estate, which in Pennsylvania is not accurate because technically your trust is supposed to be attached to your inheritance tax return, Pennsylvania's death tax, when you pass away, and that death tax return becomes public record. So the trust, if people are looking in the right place, they're going to find your trust document. So it doesn't really provide privacy in Pennsylvania. It does not save taxes. That's one that I hear a lot. I'm going to save mm-hmm. taxes by putting it into trust. You're not saving taxes. If anything, you're saving probate fees.
And you're not saving taxes because you said it's... Well, we say revocable or revocable, so
right.
People have different sayings. But because you can change your mind and mm-hmm. revoke it, that's why it's still going to be subject to the inheritance tax.
Correct. You own it, so if you own it upon your death, Pennsylvania will still tax it.
Okay, so if you're maintaining control, so that's a revocable trust or a living trust, various reasons to have them. Maybe more reasons not to have it. So that's a conversation mm-hmm. you have to have for your own circumstances. So we've got about a minute, Nick, before our next break. So I want to talk about irrevocable trusts when we come back from the break. Let me wrap a little bit about the living trust. There was all this talk that years ago, again, about people saying the fees, it may be applicable if you're a resident of another state. People, residents of Florida, have a terrible probate process. So if you have good friends who are snowbirds but live, you know, are residents of Florida because they're down there for more than 6 months of the year, and you're up here at the diner talking about probate and not, just understand that their circumstances may be different than yours. And this is what I try to stress, you know, talking to friends, getting some insight into encouraging estate planning. I love that. But you have to understand that your circumstances are your own, and you need to do your own planning with your own attorney. Folks, we are at our second break. If you have questions, we are live and would love to help you out. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. If you're not comfortable talking live with us, you can give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it in. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY offers many choices and real voices.
This is Rosalie.
And Steve.
Join us and other hosts each Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. for Swing Sunday, a great mix of swing, big band, and classic vocals.
WDIY is the Lehigh Valley's local source for NPR news, public affairs, and diverse music at 88.1 FM and streaming on WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and I have with me this evening Nick Nanovic, attorney with Gross McGinley, and we are talking about trust. When do they make sense? Oh, I forgot to mention, Nick, did I mention that you're also an accredited estate planner? Did I mention that earlier? Yes.
I think you may have.
Okay. So that's a good designation. Living trust. I also want to mention, before we move on, that a living trust, Nick mentioned, was something that you retain control of as well. And so you'll hear about people moving assets into their living trust. The example was if you have a home outside of Pennsylvania, you put your home in that trust. That's great. It avoids ancillary probate and things like that. Some people will put other assets into that trust, too. They may put a brokerage account. They may put a bank account. Because you've maintained control of those and retained control of them, the IRS allows you to keep the reporting ID number for those types of trust as your Social Security number, and you report the income on those assets just like you do, you know, your wages and your bank interest on your own personal income tax return. So that's typically living trust, or as we said, revocable living trust. All right. Now let's talk about irrevocable, the scarier ones. Let's talk about what is an irrevocable trust. What does that mean? And maybe give an example of where you might see one.
Sure. So an irrevocable trust essentially is the opposite of a revocable trust in the sense that once it's created and funded, the creator of that trust can't change it. Generally speaking, there's always exceptions to everything, but generally speaking, once that irrevocable trust is created and funded, it's there. Whatever rules you had your lawyer put into the document, those are the rules that are going to have to be used to manage those assets for however long that trust lasts. Some common areas where irrevocable trusts are used may be with a life insurance trust. That's a type of irrevocable trust that was very common, at least especially back in the early 2000s, late 90s, when you had a federal estate tax exemption amount that was fairly low compared to most people's net worth and death benefits on their life insurance policies. So to avoid the life insurance policy being taxed in their estate, they would have this irrevocable trust owned the life insurance policy. So when they passed, they did not own the asset. This irrevocable trust did, and they did not have control over the irrevocable trust, so therefore the government could not tax it.
Okay, yeah, because unlike Pennsylvania inheritance tax returns, we do not have to report life insurance.
Correct.
Okay, so for federal estate tax purposes, if someone owned the policy, the IRS required us to report the proceeds.
Yes.
The death benefit.
The death benefit of it.
Okay. So when you said you saw them more often, you know, in the 90s, the 2000s, because the federal exemption at one time, I mean, was 600. I remember when it was 600,000. Nick probably doesn't remember when it was 600,000, but I remember it was 600,000. Then it went up to 675 and then a million. So a lot of people had estates those sizes. So they had to do some clever planning sometimes with their attorneys. And the attorney would say, hey, life insurance is a no-brainer. Have somebody right. else own that. And usually it would be an irrevocable life insurance. So the insured or the decedent in this case could still pick the beneficiary and have the beneficiary in the trust then. The trust would be the beneficiary of the life insurance policy, but they control the management provisions within that, right?
Absolutely. So you have this life insurance policy that would escape that federal taxation.
Okay.
You mentioned, you know, what it was not too long ago, $600,000, $675,000. A lot of people, I think even back then, had death benefits that were more than that.
Yeah.
So you add that on to their house, their bank accounts, their retirement plans. And the other key factor with the estate tax is the rate once you go over the exemption ranges between 40 and 55% over the years, currently 40%. So it's a large chunk that the IRS takes if you ever exceed that.
So that could have been a very good planning. So someone might even still have, well, I'm sure there's still a lot out there. So you mentioned when you set up that irrevocable trust, you better know what you're doing because you said you're setting up the rules then. So where might someone get into trouble? And folks, I want to put this back within the parameter of what we're talking about tonight. When do trusts make sense? And you have to understand sometimes the perspective of when you're setting up a trust, what the use of it is for, because where might someone get into trouble if they're setting up irrevocable trusts, setting up the rules 20 years ago?
Yeah, setting up the rules 20 years ago, they're basically locking into something that's going to make it very difficult for them to change in the future. You know, it really comes down to what was the purpose of putting it into an irrevocable trust in the first place? Was it well thought out, or was it a form that was found online? I mean, that may not have been the issue back in the 90s, but nowadays it is. You find a website, a blog, it's misunderstood, miscommunicated, and you print out documents, and now you don't realize what you actually did. There's ways to fix those, but they're difficult, often involving court proceedings. So it's very important just really think out, why are you doing an irrevocable trust in the first place?
Now, when you're writing documents today, though, do you anticipate the law changes that you can't anticipate when you're writing?
No. Congress is, I would have no hair left if I tried to plan what Congress was going to do next year and the year after. It's impossible to predict what that will be. So it's another situation you're walking into, locking this money in, these assets into some sort of rules and plans without knowing how the laws may impact it going forward.
So you really work with the client to make sure that you understand what their ultimate goal is and kind of help them navigate. Does it make sense to have some irrevocable trust or rules around whatever other kind of trust provisions they may
absolutely
think they need?
Absolutely. And the other key component to that when I'm doing that analysis is, you know, how old is the person and what is their net worth? Because again, once the money is in this trust, it's very difficult to ever pull it back out. So if you're someone in your 30s, 40s, even 50s or so, before you give away a large chunk of your assets, think it through. Talk to your financial advisors, accountants, other people. Are you going to need this later in life? Does it make sense to give it away now? Or is this something you should be storing away and controlling as a separate type of insurance policy to make sure that you have to take care of your well-being while you live through your 70s, 80s, 90s maybe?
Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about elder care planning or Medicaid planning tonight at all. But Nick, sometimes I see people think I have to get rid of my assets and they want to throw it in some kind of an irrevocable trust, and really it could backfire on them.
It can. And I've had many of those conversations where people are thinking, okay, we're planning well enough ahead of this. people, I think, are learning more and more that, at least in Pennsylvania, there's a five-year look back with Pennsylvania as far as what they look at regarding large transfers of assets. And the problem becomes, though, you think, okay, I'm going to transfer these assets into this irrevocable trust. I'm going to live another 5 years, and then I'm going to qualify for Medicaid. Great. They don't think about what could go wrong with that. What if the person passes away 2 years into it, 3 years into it? And there could be big income tax issues with that. If you give something with a high amount of appreciation, say you have $500,000 worth of stock, but you paid $20,000 for it decades ago, now you transferred the stock with this unrealized $480,000 of income, thinking that you're doing it to qualify for Medicaid, you end up dying before it even benefits you, and now your family who inherits the stocks, because it's coming through an irrevocable trust, they're paying tax on $480,000
of income. There's no step up in basis.
Correct. If it was left in your own personal name and in your estate, the basis gets stepped up and no one would pay any income tax after death.
Yeah, there's so many nuances that you have to pay attention to when you're doing estate planning, and you have to especially pay attention when you're trying to get too clever with things. Folks, we are at the halfway point. We are talking with attorney Nick Nanovic of Gross McGinley. We are talking about trust. When do they make sense? If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY 88.1, it's 6:30. Your current temperature is 43. Tonight, we can have a chance of rain, mainly before 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Increasing clouds with a low around 38. Thursday, a slight chance of showers after 1 p.m., partly sunny with a high near 45. On Thursday night, low around 20. Friday is going to be sunny with a high near 30. Friday night, mostly clear with a low around 18 degrees. Saturday is going to be a chance of snow before 4 p.m., high near 30. Saturday night is going to be rain, snow, and sleet before 10 p.m., low around 29. And for your Sunday, is going to be a chance of snow showers before 7 a.m., partly sunny with a high near 36, and Sunday night breezy with a low around 20. Now back to your financial choices with Lori Siebert.
Thank you, Shandi. Welcome back, folks. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live, you can give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and she'll bring it into the studio. Again, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. So we are talking again with attorney Nick Nanovic of Gross McGinley. We're talking about trusts. When do they make sense? And some related topics around that. Speaking of related topics, Nick, when I was pulling your bio off the website, I saw it looks like you guys are doing a blog. Now, I don't know if that's you specifically or Gross McGinley, but a blog on the Secure Act. And next week, I am talking about the Secure Act, but I think we should touch on it tonight because it could affect a lot of estate planning. So can you tell us a little bit about the blog that you guys are putting out and how particularly to estate planning the recent changes might impact?
Sure. So, yeah, our firm website, grossmckinley.com, has a webpage where we post blog articles. I recently contributed one on the Secure Act, which was just approved and signed into law in late December. So a nice New Year gift for everyone. Overall, there's a lot of great changes. I'm sure you'll talk about a lot of that next week with making 401ks more available to employees, pushing back the RMD dates. But it's created a big challenge for estate planners. And what it's done is that the old rules before the Secure Act was when someone inherited a traditional retirement plan of some sort, a 401k, an IRA, 403b through a nonprofit, when they inherited that, they were only forced to take out minimum amounts over their remaining lifetime. So if someone inherits it in their 40s and they live into their 80s, you can slowly pull out that money for another 40 years. And the benefit of that was that it wouldn't push you through higher income tax brackets when you reported that income on your personal income tax return. Now what's changed with the SECURE Act is that those retirement plans, with a few exceptions, but generally has to be liquidated within 10 years after the original owner dies. So now you have this situation where you're going to have some people with very large retirement assets where their beneficiaries are going to have to report all this income within a 10-year period. And that's going to create a lot of income tax problems for them. Their tax bills are going to be a lot larger than it would have been under the old rules. And where it really comes in impacting estate plans is that many people, many of my own clients, many other clients of other lawyers I know, would run these distributions from retirement plans through trust. So instead of the beneficiary, instead of your kids or grandkids controlling how much you want to pull out of this retirement plan they're inheriting, because they're not, if they were the direct beneficiary, they're not bound by the minimum amount. If they want to liquidate the whole thing foolishly and pay the taxes, they would be allowed to do that. So a lot of people would set it up so that the trustee of this trust that's created is the one who decides how much to pull out each year and then push it through to the beneficiaries. With the SECURE Act, it's going to make it very challenging trying to decide what is the client's real goal. Because you used to do it so that the minimum amount would come through the trust and that minimum amount would be pushed out to the beneficiary. And in an ideal world, that's the most that the trustee would have to pull out. Hopefully there would be enough other assets to take care of the beneficiaries that the rest of the IRA could be left alone. And you would push it through because trust pay taxes. They go through the tax brackets much quicker than individuals do. I forget the exact number, but
about $12,000, you're at the top bracket.
Between $12,000 and $13,000, you're paying the top tax rate of what's now 37%. And most individuals know they're not hitting that 37% until they're in the $500,000-$600,000 worth of income. So it's better to get that income into an individual's name instead of keeping it trapped inside of a trust. So you had this dynamic before this past year where you want to take out the minimum amount, push it to the beneficiary, least amount of tax gets paid, great. Now with the IRAs being forced to be liquidated within 10 years, you have this quagmire of what's more important, minimizing the tax bill that goes to the government by pushing the income out to the beneficiary, which will be in 10 years after the person dies, or is it more important to protect that money for the more long term, where you don't want that beneficiary to have all that money in 10 years? You may want it to last for 20, 30, 40 years. And if you do it, you can, but by keeping it in the trust, you're paying more taxes.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a balancing act, and it's made the conversations more challenging, people's decision-making more challenging, trying to figure out what's more important in those situations.
So for people who passed in 2019 or prior, who might have already had their estate planning documents done with this beneficiary designation to the trust, their required minimum distributions stay on the old law.
Correct.
The old law. So for someone who might have set this up, who hasn't died yet, they might have that trust set up and their beneficiary designation right now today might say, my trust is my beneficiary.
Absolutely.
So they got to get into the office ASAP and you got to think things through. I want to put an example to this, Nick.
Please.
So we have someone who has $1 million IRA and they have one child, and the one child maybe has struggled finding their way. Maybe they've played with drugs. Maybe they've played with the wrong people. And let's say I'm the mom, or it's me and I have no one else, and it's just this kid I have. So I have this $1 million IRA. I don't know where their life's going to take them. They could turn out just fine. They could be wonderful, but I'm nervous. So I say, hey, can we make, I come to you and I say, hey, Nick, can we make the trust the beneficiary IRA? And you say, of course.
Absolutely.
Old laws, of course, is a great idea.
Yeah.
We do minimum required distributions. You could put some rules in the trust, as you mentioned earlier, where a trustee can say, hey, kid, we're just going to give them the minimum amount. Now the kid's doing better. Trustee might have some discretion and could give more. Mm-hmm. Okay. But those minimum required distributions on a 50-year life of $1 million, I can't do the math, might be $2,000 a year or something like that. Now we're in 2020. It's the same $1 million account. It's the same kid. 10 years, $100,000. If and you don't have to take it out evenly over 10 years.
Correct.
So you can do it any time within 10 years.
Correct.
Okay, so we could do none in the first year, and we could do a million in the 10th year.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's say I want to try to say, let's smooth this out, and I want to do $100,000 a year. That's still a pretty big number.
That's going to push that beneficiary up through the tax brackets, and they're going to be paying some higher taxes, which is still better than what the trust would be paying on that same amount of money. But now you're putting $100,000 into the hands of this child who you had concerns about because, as you said, they didn't find their way. You know, they dropped out of school, went back to school, things like that. They had drug issues, gambling issues. Maybe there's mental health issues, whatever it is. And many times, to no fault of their own, they just have these consequences, these things in life that they struggle with. And so you don't want to see people take advantage of them, take this money from them, or for them to use it foolishly. So you set up this plan, and before 2020, it was a very good plan. There was nothing wrong with the document. There was nothing wrong with the beneficiary designation or anything else that you did under law at that time. It was a great plan. The amount that would come out, maybe $10,000, all right, that's a good amount of money, but compared to the other $990,000 that stays protected, it's not that bad. When you're talking now about forcing out $1 million in a 10-year period, that's a lot that you're putting into this troubled person's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so now people have to make the decision, what's more important, minimizing the taxes and putting $1 million into this beneficiary's hands, or paying the piper a little bit more, paying more taxes, income taxes, and have the trust keep that money and protect it more long-term inside the trust?
I just had a thought. You know, we're not seeing as big of a need for life insurance mm-hmm. as we had in the past because of the federal estate tax exemption mm-hmm. going to 11.4 still or 11.5 now?
11.58 this year.
Okay, 11.5 something. And so maybe we should have them keep the life insurance policies to pay for the income tax yeah. on these accelerated required minimum distributions. Because even when you have someone who is a professional who may have built up a really big retirement account, I mean, mm-hmm. you can have people with $3 million, $4 million right. IRAs. If you have an only child and maybe they're just as successful as you and they're pulling down $500,000 you know, on Wall Street or something, and now they have to pull a $3 million IRA out over 10 years.
Yeah, that's a large chunk of money yeah. going back to the government now.
Yeah, so a lot more planning needs to be addressed. And Nick, if you have, back to our example of $1 million IRA and you decide to take $100,000 out over, you know, 10 years to try to manage the tax consequence. If that $100,000 from the trust document was written before the law, written before the law, but the person died after 2019, so 2020, and it's $100,000 and the document says, pay it to my child. Is there any way an attorney could write in a document to redirect that $100,000 and still have it reported on the individual's tax return? Like, would the individual have to have their own trust?
That's going to be difficult. And basically, you're stuck that if the person dies with a traditional retirement plan, so it's deferred income, someone has to report it.
Okay, so if we're passing it to the individual, the individual's got it.
Correct.
That's why they're reporting it, because yeah. it's in their control. Okay, so the blog, anything else? So we've talked about the required minimum distribution. We didn't say the exception. So one mm-hmm. of the exceptions to that 10-year rule is a spouse.
That's correct. So spouses can still roll over the retirement plans into their own retirement plans, which is, generally speaking, a good plan. Make it your own and then set it according to your own age expectancy, your own life expectancy, based on the tables that the IRS provides.
Okay. The other thing that people might want to think about then in their estate planning, in my example, you might have more than one child, spread it out. You might have grandchildren. Mm-hmm. You might want to think about naming more people. than you would have before. You might have said my children, but maybe now you're going to say my children and my grandchildren.
No, that's a very good point. So instead of breaking up an IRA in between two or three children, say it's broken up between maybe 10 children and grandchildren. So now instead of $1 million going over 10 years to two people, you have $1 million going over 10 years to 10 people. And because it's broken up into much smaller fractions, goes on to each person's individual income tax return, there's going to be a smaller tax bill. It's not going to push those individuals through the tax brackets as quickly as if it's just put onto the children's tax returns.
Okay, something to think about that. Mm-hmm. And then the parents of those grandchildren can also give their child a gift of estate planning for themselves.
Yes.
When they become instant millionaires. Folks, we are at our last break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. We're talking with attorney Nick Nanovic of Gross McGinley, and we're talking about trusts. When do they make sense? We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY, Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11, offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Financial Choices with Lori Siebert. My guest this evening is attorney Nick Nanovic with Gross McGinley, and we are talking about trusts, when do they make sense, and other related topics to estate planning. So the Secure Act, you guys have a blog, and you said that's on your website, grossmcginley.com.
Yes.
Okay. And is it easy to find the blog on the website?
Yeah, I believe at the top of the web page, the home page, there's a tab for blogs.
Okay, very good. Let's circle back to something we were kind of talking about earlier. Again, whether trusts make sense or not. It's not just about whether they make sense. It's about changing estate environment, folks. And the old rules, people don't even realize the old rules change. So it's very important to kind of revisit your own estate planning. The exemption, the federal exemption, many years ago was $600,000. And a lot of people might have done their estate planning back then, went in, had their attorneys write the documents. They put them in the vault, in the safe deposit box, and think they've done it once and done and never look at it again. Nick, how often do you see people come in with really old documents, and what does it mean? What do they need to do? Why does it matter?
Sure. I've seen people come in with documents that are 3 years old. I've seen people that come in with documents that are 53 years old.
Oh.
It gets interesting sometimes. And the clients themselves, they kind of laugh at themselves like, yeah, we should have done this 30 years ago. but you get to see what these plans were back during those times and really evaluate, one, their life circumstances most likely have changed a lot, but two, how have the laws changed that may give them an opportunity to either make their plans better or while making them better, even possibly simplify them.
Yeah. So, for example, when we talk about the exemption, back in the day, they would use something called a credit shelter trust, and attorneys also have a bunch of names for those. Mm-hmm. But it could have been good planning back then, but now it might tie the hands of a surviving spouse if there's something called the credit shelter trust. Can you give us kind of a broad view of that for people who are listening who might not even realize they have it?
Sure. I mean, this was a very common thing that if you walked into a lawyer's office, it would always be recommended, oh, you need a AB trust. You need a marital trust and credit shelter trust type of provision in it. And again, based on the laws at that time, that may have been a very wise choice for many people. It may have impacted the majority of the population. I'm not sure the statistics on it, but it affected a lot more people back then than it does nowadays. And basically the way that planning worked was, when you had the exemption amount at $600,000, whatever was over that generally was taxable at that 40%, 50%, whatever the rate was, unless it went to your spouse. You had a marital deduction. So the planning was, you would try to take the entire exemption amount, whatever it is, $600, $675, put it into the trust for the next generation. Make sure you maximize that credit. And that you
Because
pass
that
along.
Credit was per person.
Per person. And if you didn't use it upon your death, it was lost. And then whatever is left over, you give it to your spouse, and the tax on that, if there is going to be any, it gets deferred until the second spouse dies. Because if you did the opposite, if you just gave your spouse everything, your surviving spouse now only has his or her own credits, and the credit that you had was wasted. You passed away, and that credit of $600,000 never got used. So back in 2010, there were some temporary laws, and 2012 became permanent, of this thing called portability, meaning that if a spouse dies and didn't do any of this type of planning and just gave everything to the surviving spouse, you can port over the credit that the first spouse had. So the surviving spouse now has two persons' credits, the first spouse's and their own. And there's no longer much of a need to do this AB trust, credit shelter, marital trust type of planning. If you still have it in your documents, what may ultimately end up happening is that when the first spouse dies, you have these assets locked up inside of a credit shelter trust. And now the spouse who survives is kind of stuck a little bit. There's going to be some red tape. There's going to be some administrative things that have to be done to pull this money out of this trust if the spouse needs it during his or her remaining lifetime. Mm-hmm. So with that law change and with the ever-growing exemption amount, which is, we mentioned, $11.58 million now, it may be a good time for a lot of people with these older plans to simplify. Cut out all those provisions and just simply say, my husband, my wife gets everything. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly fine, because if it's needed at the time that you pass, that surviving spouse can file the return to make sure they double up their credit. So they have their own credit and the credit of their predeceased spouse.
So to get that credit, that to elect that portability, you mm-hmm. do still file a federal estate tax return on the first spouse.
Correct. You file a federal estate tax return, but IRS over the past couple years, since this has been in existence, have passed some regulations and some revenue rulings stating that they'll accept less detailed federal estate tax returns than they would expect to receive if there was an actual tax due.
Mm-hmm.
They say if you're filing for the sole purpose of to give this credit to the surviving spouse, it shouldn't be as much work to file it. And also the timeline's extended. It's not necessarily due 9 months after date of death. I think it may be 2 years is mm-hmm. what they're allowing for mm-hmm. now. But you do need to file that return to lock in to that predeceased spouse's
credit. And check that
credit.
Box for portability.
Absolutely.
And that really could be very important for people who maybe have several million. I mean, it could be important for everybody mm-hmm. If your surviving spouse wins the lottery or a big lawsuit or something. But
or if the law changes back.
I mean, that's what I was going to say. So for people who are maybe at 4 million, mm-hmm. 3 million.
Correct. And depending on their age and what that's invested in, if it's a startup business that's going gangbusters and could be worth 20, 30 million in 10 years, that's something worth considering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one can predict that, but it's a consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And where we're at with current law with the 11.58 million, that's set to expire around 2026, the mm-hmm. year 2026.
Mm-hmm.
After that, it's reverting back. It's still going to be a fairly high amount, 5 million plus inflation since 2000, mm-hmm. Since 2010. But it's going to decrease unless Congress changes the laws again, which they may, but there's no way for us to predict that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason that a surviving spouse may want to be proactive and file that federal estate tax return to lock into that credit. Just to be conservative and have it there.
So if anyone who's listening has older documents, mm-hmm. It would be worth reviewing, because these trusts were also not always separate trusts. they were sometimes written within the will, back to how we started the show, correct, talking about testamentary trust, usually for minor children. But sometimes an attorney would put it in the will because they didn't know if they would need a separate trust or not. And so absolutely, they'd just throw in that credit shelter language. So you might have it and not even really realize it or think about yeah, it. And I know attorneys send letters to clients saying, remember, come in and kind of refresh your documents, but a lot of people throw those to the side and don't do it.
They see mailers come in the mailbox, it gets tossed, they see their inbox gets flooded, and this looks like it's just advertising marketing, I don't have to read it.
Yeah.
And that's their choice, that's fine, but there's things that people need to keep updated with them to see how it might impact them and their families.
Okay, so we've talked throughout the evening about when trust makes sense, not as much as they used to in the past. So something definitely to refresh. I know there's people who get kind of fancy with trust now sometimes too, again, trying to do elder planning and Medicaid planning. So I'm not going to get into that. We don't have enough time. But there is some flexibility that attorneys can put in the language that we've talked about. Flexible language that may help a trustee make a decision in the future for a beneficiary, maybe like discretion, mm-hmm, a trust protector you hear more and more about. I'd never even heard of one, a handful of years ago.
A trust protector is something that I'm very passionate about clients having in their documents.
Okay.
It's a provision that I rarely see anyone bring in their existing documents.
Right.
Part of it is that Pennsylvania does not have any strong laws and statutes on it. There's legislation pending. We'll see what comes of that. But generally speaking, it's an accepted role. And what a trust protector is basically someone who serves in a role who can make some adjustments after these documents are drafted and maybe after they become irrevocable. So instead of going through the whole court process, a trust protector could be given certain powers to change certain things. The most common way I use them is to give a trust protector power to replace trustees. So that way, if the trustees you name in your document, maybe you go down through two of them and neither of them are no longer well suited to be trustees. They've moved out of the area, they have illnesses, they have their own personal situations, or they've died. Now you have no one in the document anymore who's going to be a trustee. And if you come up with that vacancy, if you don't have a trust protector with a power to appoint someone new, you're now going to court and filing petitions and hiring lawyers to do all this paperwork in the court system. So a trust protector can fill a quick need by having that power to add a trustee into a vacancy.
Does that trust protector have to be someone they know at the time they're doing the document? Do I have to say my neighbor Sally or my whatever?
It should be identified as someone specific, yes.
Okay, not necessarily a corporate trustee or someone like that.
No, the corporate trustees, they will be trustees. I'm not aware of any corporations that serve as trust protectors.
Okay.
They may exist. I'm just not aware of them.
Okay, so the trust protector might be, because I'm thinking if you have someone that you've named first and second, let's say you name your brother and your sister, mm-hmm, and something happens to them, and my trust protector might be my cousin. Could that trust protector step in and be the representative? Would they be allowed to do that?
It could be written that way. I usually don't like to give the trust protector that much discretion, because now there's a little bit of self-interest involved.
Okay.
Ideally, to me, and again, everyone's different, to me, the trust protector should be someone completely independent with nothing to gain out of helping anything. It's really just someone who's very friendly to the situation, to the family dynamic, and will just be there, not as a watchdog, but someone on the sideline to be called upon if there's ever any issues that need to be fixed.
Okay, because it might not be to replace the trustees. It might be to make a decision about a change in how you're paying out the income.
Correct.
Okay, yeah, all right.
It could be done that way, too.
Okay, wonderful. Nick, we just have a minute left. Okay. Do you want to leave any parting words or advice to our listeners as far as estate planning?
No, just generally, when to look for updates to your estate plan. We talked about law changes. Power of attorney laws in Pennsylvania changed about 6 years ago. We had the SECURE Act that's now impacting lots of people. Law changes are always big things, but otherwise, if there's ever a major life event, you get married, you get divorced, there's a new person in your life that's born, a child, a grandchild, someone in your family passes away, it's a good time to dust off those documents and remind yourself what they say, because what your memory may be about those documents may not actually be how they're going to operate after you're gone. So it's worthwhile, even if you don't have those major life events, maybe every 5 years, dust them off and see what they say.
It's great advice. Thank you, Nick. Also, if people would like to reach you, what is your number?
Sure. It's 610-820-5450. And my email is nnanovic@grossmcginley.com.
And Nanovic is N for Nick, N-A-N-O-V-I-C.
Yep.
Nanovic.
Strong Slovak name.
nnanovic@grossmcginley.com.
Correct.
Nick, thank you so much. And folks, also, they have their blog on that website, grossmcginley.com as well. Nick, thanks so much. I hope you come on again.
Yeah,
this was
great. Thank you for having me. Long time coming. This has been fantastic.
Okay, thanks for coming. Thank you, listeners. We really appreciate your time. And this show will also be available as a podcast probably within the next 2 or 3 days. And you can find podcast at wdiy.org under local programming, your financial choices. Lori, thanks for being here, and Shandi as well. Next week, we are talking about the Secure Act in a little bit more detail and how it affects you. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller within the tradition folk music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.